Imagine for a second that this massive multi-million dollar company just completely implodes.
Like total bankruptcy.
Right, total bankruptcy, the doors are locked, the lights are off, and the liquidators are called in. Now, the banks that lent the money, they get their millions back. The bondholders, they get a check.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, eventually. But the person who actually held the title of, like, owner of that company, they walk away with absolutely nothing. Not a single cent.
It sounds like a total scam, honestly.
It really does. But I mean, it's actually the foundational bedrock of global corporate finance. So welcome to the deep dive. And real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
And, that brutal reality of the financial system we just mentioned, it makes perfect mathematical sense once you actually understand the underlying architecture of the capital.
Right.
And that is exactly our mission today. We are mastering the types of equity securities for your Series 66 exam prep.
Yeah, because if you're prepping for the 66, you already know what a stock is. I mean, you learned that for the Series 7. You don't need us to, like, read you a glossary.
No, absolutely not.
So what we're doing today is we're ripping up the floorboards. We're going to look at the wiring, the plumbing, and the underlying logic of why common stock, preferred stock, and ADRs function the way they do.
Because the test writers, they know you have the basics down. They aren't going to ask you for a simple definition.
Right.
They're going to test you on the hybrid nature of these securities. They want to see if you understand the causality.
Like, what happens to the price of a preferred stock when the Federal Reserve suddenly hikes interest rates?
Exactly. Or, who gets paid first when the company liquidates? What happens to a foreign dividend when the currency market crashes?
And to make sure this actually sticks in your brain, because let's face it, corporate finance can get a little dry if we aren't careful, we're going to be hanging out with a few recurring fictional characters today.
Think of them as, like, your study group.
Yeah, your study group. So first up, we have founder Fiona. Fiona is the ambitious, visionary, and let's be honest, slightly chaotic CEO of Fiona's Flying Cars.
She is the issuer. She's the one raising the capital, making the rules, and deciding exactly who gets a slice of the pie.
Right. Fiona is our perfect stand-in for the corporate entity. Now, on the completely opposite side of the table, we have cautious Carl.
Ah, Carl.
Yeah, Carl is a retail investor. He is terrified of losing his nest egg. He's constantly looking for, a safety net, priority in the payout line, anything resembling a guaranteed return.
He just wants to sleep at night.
Exactly. And finally, lurking in the shadows of the corporate finance department, wearing a very expensive pinstripe suit, is corporate Chris.
Corporate Chris only cares about one thing.
Yep. Chris is a corporate treasurer for a massive conglomerate. He doesn't care about the flying cars. He doesn't care about the product. He is entirely focused on exploiting tax loopholes, utilizing dividend deductions, and maximizing yield for his own corporation's massive cash reserves.
And look, as we navigate this material, we're going to speak directly to you, the listener. We know sitting through dry lectures is tough, especially if you've got ADHD or just lose focus easily.
Oh, yeah.
So we are going to keep the energy up. We're going to put you in the hot seat. We will periodically stop the conversation, ask you a direct question about the mechanics we just discussed, and, like, give you a few seconds to lock in an answer in your head before we explain it.
It is so crucial that you actively think through the logic rather than just passively letting us talk at you.
Active recall is the only way to beat this exam.
Right. So let's get right into the baseline, the absolute core of equity ownership, which is common stock. If cautious Carl takes his money, logs into his brokerage account, and buys one single share of Fiona's Flying Cars, he is officially a part owner of a sprawling multi-million dollar manufacturing corporation.
He owns a microscopic fractional sliver of the factory, the patents, the tools, the unfinished hover sedans on the assembly line.
But the word ownership in corporate finance doesn't mean what it means when you own a house or a car.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, Carl can't walk into the factory and demand to take a wrench home just because he's a part owner.
I'd like to see him try.
Right. Security would throw him out immediately. His ownership rights are strictly intangible and highly structured. The most significant tangible right Carl actually receives is the right to vote.
Yeah, let's unpack that voting right, because this is where the balance of power really comes into play. Typically, Carl gets one vote for every share he owns. So, he has 100 shares, he has 100 votes. But what is he actually voting on?
He's not voting on what color to paint the flying cars.
No. He's voting on existential corporate matters.
Correct. The shareholders vote to elect the board of directors, the people who actually oversee Fiona and the executive team. They vote on structural changes, like a massive merger or an acquisition.
Stock splits, too.
Yeah, stock splits and amendments to the corporate charter.
Okay, wait a second, though. If Carl is the owner and he gets to elect the board of directors, why doesn't he get to vote on how much he gets paid? I mean, I would love to vote on my own paycheck.
We all would.
But Carl doesn't get to vote on the dividends. That seems like a massive oversight in his so-called ownership rights.
Well, it's not an oversight. It's a very deliberate legal separation of powers.
Yeah.
And this is a fundamental concept for the exam. Shareholders own the company, but the board of directors manages the company.
Right.
The board has a fiduciary duty to ensure the long-term survival and growth of the corporation. If you let shareholders vote on dividends, I mean, what would happen?
They just drain it.
Exactly. They would just vote to empty the company's bank accounts every single quarter to enrich themselves, and the company would go bankrupt the moment they hit a rough patch.
Ah, the tragedy of the commons. So Fiona and her board have an absolute firewall around the cash. Even if Fiona's flying cars has an absolute blowout year-like, let's say they sell 1 million units, revenue is up 500%, and they are literally swimming in cash.
Yeah.
Fiona does not have to pay Carl a single dime.
Not a dime. This is the dividend reality of common stock. Common stock dividends are entirely variable, and they are never, ever guaranteed.
Never.
The board can look at that massive pile of profit and say, you know what? We're paying zero dividends this year because we want to build a brand new factory on the moon. And Carl has no legal recourse. He cannot sue them for a dividend.
He just has to sit there and hope that the moon factory eventually makes the stock price go up so he can sell his shares later for a capital gain. So Carl's dividends are completely at the mercy of Fiona, but it actually gets worse for Carl. Let's talk about the absolute worst case scenario. Let's say the moon factory is a disaster. The flying cars keep exploding on launch. The company goes totally bankrupt and they enter Chapter 7 liquidation.
This is an area where candidates frequently lose points on the exam
because
they don't fully internalize the strict, legally mandated hierarchy of corporate liquidation.
You really have to know exactly who gets paid, in what exact order, when a company's assets are sold off for scraps.
Right.
To visualize this, I want you to picture a massive corporate buffet line, but the kitchen is closed, the food is running out, and there are way too many people waiting to eat.
I love this analogy.
So first in line, literally kicking the doors down and walking straight up to the carving station, are the secured creditors.
These are the heavy hitters. A secured creditor is a bank or an institution that lent Fiona money, but they specifically demanded collateral.
Yeah, they didn't just trust her.
No, they said, Fiona, we'll lend you $50 million, but if you don't pay us back, we get the legal deed to your primary manufacturing facility.
Mm-hmm.
Because their debt is tied to a hard asset, they eat first. They take the prime rib.
They get exactly what they were promised. Now, right behind them, second in line, are the unsecured creditors and the bondholders. Now, these folks lent Fiona money, too, but they didn't ask for a specific building as collateral.
Right. They just took her full face and credit promise to pay them back.
Which is way riskier.
It's much riskier than being a secured creditor because they don't have a specific asset to seize. They just get in line for the general pool of cash that the liquidators managed to scrape together from selling off office chairs and whatever else is left.
So they step up to the buffet and they scoop up all the mashed potatoes and the gravy.
Exactly.
Okay. Third in line, looking a little nervous at this point, are the preferred stockholders. Now, we are going to dive really deep into preferred stock in a few minutes, but for now, just know that their name literally means they get a preference in this exact scenario.
They managed to scrape the bottom of the salad bowl. You had to get some wilted lettuce and maybe a stray crouton.
And then finally, at the very back of the room is the owner of the company.
Cautious Carl.
Cautious Carl, the common stockholder. He is standing at the back of the buffet line holding an empty plastic Tupperware container. By the time it's his turn to step up to the food, the trays are completely empty. They've been licked clean by the secured creditors, the bondholders, and the preferred stockholders. Carl gets absolutely nothing.
This is the classic misdirection on the exam. They will ask you, in a corporate liquidation, which of the following stakeholders bears the maximum financial risk?
And what do people usually guess?
The intuitive but wrong answer that many people jump to is the bondholders because they think, oh, they lent the company millions of dollars. But the correct answer is always, always the common stockholder.
Because the common stockholder is the residual claimant. That's the fancy finance term for the guy with the empty Tupperware. You only get what is left over, and in a bankruptcy, there is never anything left over.
Never. But we have to explain why this system exists. It's not just to punish Carl.
Right, there's logic to it.
It's the fundamental equation of risk and reward. Because Carl is at the very bottom of the liquidation priority, his investment is incredibly risky. Therefore, to entice him to buy the stock in the first place, the market offers him unlimited upside potential.
Yes. If Fiona's company takes off and becomes a trillion-dollar monopoly, the secured creditors don't get $1 trillion. They just get their original loan back plus their flat interest rate.
The bondholders just get their flat interest rate too.
All of that massive exponential profit growth flows directly to the value of Carl's common stock.
Unlimited upside, but with a hard floor on the downside. This is the beauty of the modern corporate structure, right?
Yeah.
Limited liability.
Right, limited liability.
If Carl buys $1,000 worth of Fiona's flying cars, the absolute worst thing that can happen is that the stock goes to zero. He loses his $1,000.
Yeah, Fiona can't call Carl up in the middle of the night and say, "Hey, Carl, the company owes the bank another $10 million, and since you're a part owner, I need you to wire me your share of the debt." His risk is capped at his initial investment.
Exactly. So to summarize the baseline of common stock, unlimited upside potential, maximum risk in liquidation, voting rights on major corporate events, but absolutely no say in or guarantee of dividend payouts.
Okay, so Carl understands how Fiona's U.S.-based company works. He's comfortable with that risk-reward profile. But cautious Carl is reading the Wall Street Journal, and he sees a company in Germany that is making some incredible advancements in flying motorcycles.
Ooh, flying motorcycles.
Right, it's a completely different market, and he wants in. But he's cautious. He doesn't want to figure out German tax law or, like, wire money to Frankfurt. How does he invest globally without the friction?
This brings us to the brilliance and, frankly, the inherent danger of American depositary receipts, or ADRs. To understand why ADRs even exist, you have to look at the history of international investing. Decades ago, if you wanted to buy a foreign stock, it was a logistical nightmare.
Let's walk through that nightmare because it helps explain the modern system. If Carl wants to buy the German flying motorcycle stock directly, he can't just use his normal U.S. brokerage app.
No way.
He has to open a specialized foreign brokerage account. He has to take his U.S. dollars and convert them into euros, paying a massive currency exchange fee. Then he has to navigate the time zone difference to place a trade when the Frankfurt Stock Exchange is actually open.
And that's just buying it.
Right. When the company pays a dividend, they mail him a physical check in euros, which he then has to take to his local bank, pay another fee to convert back to dollars, and wait weeks for it to clear.
It was so cumbersome that almost no retail investors, and honestly, very few institutional investors, bothered with foreign equities back then. So in the 1920s, major U.S. banks, specifically J.P. Morgan, invented the ADR to solve this exact problem of friction.
So here is the mechanic of how an ADR actually comes to life. A massive U.S. depositary bank goes over to Germany. They buy a huge block of shares, let's say 10 million shares of that German flying motorcycle company. They take those physical shares and they lock them in a vault at a custodian bank over in Europe.
Those shares never leave Europe. They just sit in the vault. But back in New York, the U.S. depositary bank issues a receipt against those shares.
It's like a tote check ticket.
Exactly. They are literally receipts proving that the bank holds the foreign stock on your behalf. And these receipts, the ADRs, are what actually trade on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ.
It's an incredibly elegant wrapper. Because the ADR trades on a U.S. exchange, it is priced in U.S. dollars. Carl can log into his standard brokerage account at 10:00 a.m. New York time, search the ticker symbol, and buy the ADR just like you would buy Apple or Microsoft.
And the dividend process is completely streamlined, too. When the German company declares a dividend, they pay it in euros to the custodian bank holding the shares in the vault.
The U.S. depositary bank collects those euros, does a massive wholesale currency conversion into U.S. dollars, and then deposits those dollars directly into Carl's brokerage account.
No foreign accounts, no time zone issues, no individual currency conversion fees.
It sounds like a flawless system,
mm-hmm.
But this is where I'm going to stop the show. I am talking directly to you, the listener, right now. I am going to ask you a question based on the mechanics we just laid out. I want you to think through the logic and actually commit to an answer before the expert breaks it down.
Ready?
Here's the scenario. Cautious Carl buys the ADR. It trades in U.S. dollars on the New York Stock Exchange. His dividends are deposited into his account in US dollars. Does Carl have to worry about currency risk? Got your answer.
If you answered no, you just fell into one of the most heavily tested traps in the Series 66. The answer is emphatically yes. Carl still bears the full weight of currency exchange risk.
Okay, wait, I'm going to push back on this for Carl's sake. Why? The whole point of the ADR was to eliminate the friction of currency exchange. Carl never touched a euro. He bought in dollars. He gets paid in dollars. How is he taking on currency risk?
Because the ADR is just a wrapper. The underlying economic engine of that investment, the company itself, the physical share sitting in the vault, and the dividends being generated, they are all fundamentally priced in euros. The U.S. bank is just acting as a translator, and that translation rate changes every single day.
Okay, let's do the math on this to prove the point. Let's say Carl buys the ADR, and the German company declares a very healthy dividend of 2 euros per share. At the exact moment they pay the dividend, the global currency market is perfectly balanced. 1 euro equals 1 U.S. dollar.
Nice and easy. So the U.S. bank collects the 2 euro dividend, translates it at a 1-to-1 ratio, and hands Carl 2 U.S. dollars. Carl is thrilled.
But let's fast forward 1 year. The German company is still doing great. They're selling flying motorcycles like crazy. They declare the exact same dividend, 2 euros per share. The underlying company hasn't changed its performance at all.
However, the European economy has taken a massive hit, and the euro has significantly weakened against a very strong U.S. dollar. Let's say now the exchange rate is terrible. It takes 2 euros to buy just 1 U.S. dollar.
Oh, man. So what happens to Carl? The German company pays the 2 euros to the bank vault. The U.S. bank takes those 2 euros, goes to the currency market, and because the euro is so weak, those 2 euros only buy 1 U.S. dollar. The bank deposits $1 into Carl's account.
Carl's dividend income just got slashed by 50%. The company didn't cut the dividend. The business is thriving. But because the underlying currency depreciated against the dollar, Carl's actual return plummeted.
So ADRs remove the logistical hassle of currency exchange, but they offer absolutely zero protection against the economic risk of currency fluctuation.
Precisely. And it works in reverse, too. If the euro strengthens massively against the dollar, Carl's dividend would actually increase in dollar terms, even if the company kept the euro payout exactly the same. The currency acts as a multiplier, for better or worse.
The Examinators love that. But currency risk isn't the only unique danger of going global, right? The exam will expect you to categorize a few other macro-level risks associated with foreign equities, even when they are wrapped in an ADR.
Yeah, let's run through them quickly. First is political or sovereign risk. If Carl buys an ADR for a company operating in an emerging market, he has to worry about the stability of the government.
Like, what if there's a coup? What if a new regime decides to nationalize the flying motorcycle factory and just seize all the corporate assets?
Carl's ADR becomes worthless overnight, and there is no U.S. court that can save him.
Terrifying. Then there is regulatory and accounting risk. In the United States, we have the SEC and JAP, generally accepted accounting principles. It is highly standardized, highly regulated, and very transparent.
But a foreign company might be operating under vastly different accounting standards. They might not be required to disclose off-balance sheet debt. Their financial statements might be much murkier, making it way harder to truly evaluate the health of the company.
And finally, liquidity risk. Now, if you are buying an ADR for a massive, globally recognized company like Toyota or Sony, liquidity is fine. Millions of shares trade every day.
Right. But if Carl buys a thinly traded ADR for a very obscure foreign mining company, there might be days where almost no one is buying or selling.
And if Carl suddenly panics and needs to sell his obscure ADR immediately, there might not be a buyer on the other side of the trade. The market maker will widen the bid-ask spread to compensate for the lack of volume, and Carl will get a terrible execution price.
He'll take a huge haircut just to get out.
So common stock, whether it's domestic or an ADR, is inherently volatile. You are riding the waves of corporate earnings, liquidation priority, and global currency markets. Now, cautious Carl is looking at his portfolio and he's sweating.
He's not happy.
No. He hates the empty Tupperware at the back of the bankruptcy line. He hates the fact that Fiona can just randomly decide not to pay him a dividend. So he goes to Fiona and says, look, I want the safety and priority of a bond. I want a fixed payout and I want to be closer to the front of the line.
But Fiona looks at her balance sheet and says, Carl, I already have too much debt. My debt-to-equity ratio is stretched to the absolute limit.
If I issue any more bonds, the credit rating agencies are going to downgrade my company to junk status. I absolutely refuse to issue more debt. Where do they compromise?
They compromise by utilizing one of those fascinating instruments in corporate finance, preferred stock. I often describe preferred stock as a financial centaur.
A centaur.
Yeah, it's a true hybrid, half horse, half human. In this case, it is legally classified as one thing, but it walks, talks, and acts like something else entirely.
Let's establish the legal reality first. If the exam asks you what asset class preferred stock belongs to, the answer is unequivocally equity. It represents ownership in the corporation.
But the mechanics of how it behaves are almost entirely borrowed from the bond market. It is equity that is desperately trying to act like debt. Let's look at the primary feature that attracts someone like Carl, the dividend.
When Fiona issues preferred stock, she attaches a fixed dividend rate to it. Usually, it is stated as a percentage of a par value, typically $100. So if Fiona issues a 6% preferred stock, the math is simple. 6% of $1 is $6.
Carl buys the stock, and he expects to receive $6 a year. He loves this because he can actually plan his retirement budget around a predictable income stream.
But I have a major problem with the terminology here, and I know candidates do too. They call it a fixed dividend. If I have a fixed mortgage rate, I must pay the bank that exact amount every month or they take my house. If Fiona has a fixed preferred stock dividend, does she legally have to pay Carl that $6?
This is a critical distinction where candidates always get tripped up. The word fixed is incredibly misleading. In the bond world, fixed means mandatory. In the preferred stock world, fixed simply means the maximum rate is capped. It means if Fiona pays a dividend, it will be exactly $6. It will be $7 if the company has a great year.
But it could be zero.
Exactly. Because it is legally equity, Fiona's board of directors still has to officially vote to declare that dividend every single quarter. If Fiona looks at the cash flow and says, things are tight, we need to preserve cash, the board can simply vote to skip Carl's $6 payment.
Hold on. If Fiona skips an interest payment on a bond, the bondholders declare a breach of contract, they force the company into default, and the bankruptcy proceedings begin. Why doesn't Carl get to do that?
Because Carl is an owner, not a lender. You cannot foreclose on yourself. A missed preferred stock dividend is never an event of default. It cannot trigger bankruptcy.
That is a massive advantage for Fiona. She gets to raise capital from cautious investors who want a steady yield, but she doesn't take on any of the existential bankruptcy risk that comes with issuing debt. If times get tough, she just turns off the dividend spigot without destroying the company.
Exactly. But let's look at it from Carl's perspective. Why would he accept a capped upside of $6 while still letting Fiona have the power to skip the payment? What is he getting in return?
He is getting priority. Let's go back to our corporate liquidation buffet line. If the company goes bankrupt, Carl is no longer standing at the back of the room with an empty Tupperware container.
Right.
Because he holds preferred stock, he gets to cut in line ahead of the common stockholders. He gets the salad bowl. It's not the prime rib that the secured banks get, but it's vastly better than nothing.
And that preference applies to the dividends as well. If Fiona decides to declare a dividend, the law states she must pay the preferred stockholders their full fixed amount before she is allowed to distribute a single penny to the common stockholders. The preferred shareholders act as a dam blocking the river of cash.
So he gets priority in payout, but what does he sacrifice?
Voting rights. In almost all cases, preferred stock does not carry voting rights. Carl cannot vote for the board of directors. He trades his voice for a safer spot in line.
Okay, so preferred stock pays a fixed dividend of $6, which makes it act like a fixed income investment. And because it acts like a fixed income investment, it inherits the single biggest vulnerability of the bond market, extreme sensitivity to interest rates.
The yield seesaw.
Yes, the yield seesaw. I want to walk through the exact mechanics of this because it is counterintuitive for people who only trade common stock. Why does a stock care what the Federal Reserve is doing with interest rates?
It is all about competing yield. It is the concept of opportunity cost. Let's say Carl buys Fiona's preferred stock for $100 and it pays him $6 a year. He is getting a 6% yield. He is very happy. But 6 months later, inflation spikes and the Federal Reserve aggressively raises interest rates to cool the economy.
Now, brand new corporate bonds are hitting the market. And because rates are higher, these new bonds are paying 8% interest. And remember, bonds are safer than preferred stock because they are higher up in the buffet line and the interest payments are legally mandatory.
So put yourself in the shoes of a new investor entering the market. Would you buy Carl's riskier preferred stock yielding 6% or would you buy a safer corporate bond yielding 8%?
I would buy the 8% bond every single time. It's a no-brainer.
Exactly. So what happens if Carl suddenly needs cash and wants to sell his preferred stock? Nobody's going to pay him $100 for a 6% yield when they can get 8% elsewhere. The only way Carl can sell his shares is if he lowers the price.
He has to put his stock on discount. He has to drop the asking price from $100 down to, say, $75. Why $75? Because if a new buyer pays $75 and they still collect that fixed $6 dividend, the math works out so that their effective yield is 8%. 6 divided by 75 is 0.08, or 8%.
The market forces the price of the preferred stock down until its yield perfectly matches the new, higher interest rates in the broad economy. This is an inviolable rule of finance. When interest rates go up, the price of fixed-rate preferred stock goes down. They move inversely, exactly like a bond.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. But I want to circle back to the skipped dividends. We established that Fiona can just tell the board to skip Carl's $6 payment without triggering a default. But what actually happens to that missed money? Does Carl just cry, rip up his budget, and move on?
That is the perfect question, and it brings us to the great dividend drama. The answer to what happens to the missed money depends entirely on the exact legal structure of the preferred stock, specifically whether it is cumulative or non-cumulative.
Let's start with non-cumulative, which is also known on the street as straight preferred stock. Let's set the scene. Fiona looks at her balance sheet. Cash is tight, but she really wants to fund a vanity project. She wants to build a solid gold hover desk for her office.
Of course she does.
So she convinces the board to skip the preferred dividend this year. If Carl owns straight preferred stock, what is his legal recourse?
He has none. If he owns straight preferred stock and the dividend is skipped, that money evaporates into the ether. It is gone forever. The next year, if Fiona finishes her gold desk and decides to resume paying dividends, she only owes Carl the current year's $6. She doesn't owe him a dime for the year she skipped.
That sounds absolutely horrific for Carl. Why would anyone ever buy straight preferred stock if the company can just legally steal your yield without consequence?
It's all about the initial pricing. Because straight preferred stock is so dangerous for the investor, the market demands a premium. A company might have to offer an 8% yield on straight preferred compared to only a 6% yield on a safer version. Investors buy it because they're gambling that the company is stable enough not to skip, and they want the higher payout.
But the safer version, the one most retail investors own, is cumulative preferred stock. In fact, if the exam gives you a preferred stock question and doesn't specify which type it is, you must assume it is cumulative. That is the industry default.
Right. Cumulative preferred completely changes the power dynamic of a missed payment. It introduces the concept of arrears.
I picture arrears as a massive magical bucket sitting in Fiona's accounting department. Let's run a multi-year scenario to see how this bucket works.
I love this.
Listener, I'm talking to you again. Get your mental calculator ready. I am going to give you a scenario, and I want you to calculate the exact payout required. Ready?
Here we go.
Year one. Fiona is building a new factory. She has no cash. She skips Carl's $6 dividend. Year two. The factory is delayed. Still no cash. She skips Carl's $6 dividend again. Year three. The factory opens. It is a massive success. The company is flooded with profit. Fiona wants to celebrate by paying a massive dividend to her common shareholders, which, by the way, includes herself.
Literally.
Before Fiona can pay a single penny to the common shareholders in year three, exactly how much money does she have to pay Carl per share?
Got it.
Let's do the math and empty the bucket. In year one, she missed $6. That goes into the arrears bucket. In year two, she missed another $6. That goes into the bucket. The bucket now holds $12 of dividends in arrears.
But we aren't done. Correct. She also owes the current dividend for year three. So she takes the $12 from the arrears bucket, adds the $6 for the current year, and writes Carl a check for $18 per share. Only after Carl's check clears is she legally allowed to pay the common stockholders.
Cumulative preferred stock acts as an absolute roadblock. The board cannot reward themselves or the common shareholders until they make the cumulative preferred shareholders entirely whole.
It's a great protection.
But let me push back on this because it feels a little unfair to Carl. He had to wait 3 years to get his money. If I don't pay my credit card bill for 3 years, the bank charges me exorbitant compound interest. Does Carl get interest on his dividends in arrears?
This is a fantastic place for the exam writers to trick you because common sense says yes, but the law says no. Carl does not get a single cent of interest on his arrears.
Why? What is the legal justification for that?
It goes back to the fundamental legal difference between debt and equity. If a company misses an interest payment on a bond, they have breached a contract. They have essentially stolen money that was legally owed on a specific date and the penalty for that is accruing interest.
But a dividend isn't debt.
Exactly. A dividend is not a contractual debt. It is a discretionary distribution of profit. The board didn't steal Carl's money in year one. They just decided not to distribute profits. Because it wasn't legally owed until it was officially declared in year three, there is no interest penalty. $12 missed is just $12 paid later.
That is a brilliant distinction. So cumulative creates a bucket of arrears but pays no interest. Straight preferred vanishes into thin air.
Remember that for the test.
Now, Fiona is the CEO who likes to tinker. She doesn't just want to issue a standard vanilla preferred stock. She wants to customize the offering. What kind of aftermarket features, what bells and whistles can a corporation attach to their preferred stock to manipulate the market?
Let's explore the three most heavily tested features. The first one is a massive bonus for the investor, participating preferred stock.
Normally, the trade-off with preferred stock is that your upside is capped. Carl gets his $6, and that is it. Even if Fiona invents a flying car that runs on water and becomes the richest woman on Earth, Carl still only gets $6.
Unless he owns participating preferred stock. This feature allows Carl to double dip. He gets his guaranteed fixed dividend of $6, securing his safety net.
Right.
But if the company has a spectacularly profitable year and pays a common stock dividend that exceeds a predetermined threshold, the participating preferred stockholders get a bonus dividend on top of their fixed rate.
It bridges the gap. It gives Carl the priority and safety of preferred, but lets him participate in the unlimited upside of the common stock. It's rare, but it's incredibly valuable.
Very valuable. Now let's talk about power dynamics, because the next two features are perfect opposites of each other. Callable versus convertible preferred stock. It is all about who holds the power to change the deal.
Let's start with callable. Who does this feature benefit?
A callable feature exists entirely for the benefit of the issuer. It benefits founder Fiona.
Explain the mechanic. Why does she want this power?
A call feature gives the corporation the right, at their sole discretion, to force the investor to sell their shares back to the company at a predetermined price. It is the corporate equivalent of refinancing a mortgage.
Ah, okay.
Let's say Fiona issued Carl's preferred stock 5 years ago, and because the economy was bad, she had to offer him in an 8% dividend to get him to buy it. But today, the economy is booming and interest rates have plummeted. Fiona looks at the market and realizes that if she issued new preferred stock today, she would only have to pay a 5% dividend.
She is furious that she is still paying Carl 8% when the going rate is 5%.
Exactly. So she exercises the call feature. She essentially says, Carl, the ride is over. Here's your $100 par value back. Give me your shares. She retires those expensive 8% shares and immediately issues brand new shares to the public at 5%. She just dramatically lowered her cost of capital.
And this is an absolute disaster for Carl. He thought he had a safe 8% yield for the rest of his life. Suddenly, Fiona rips the stock away from him, hands him a pile of cash, and says, good luck. Carl now has to take that cash and reinvest it in a market where everything is only paying 5%. He suffers severe reinvestment risk.
Because this feature is so actively hostile to the investor, the market prices it accordingly. If a company wants the power to call their stock, they have to bribe the investor to accept that risk. Therefore, callable preferred stock will always pay a higher dividend yield than standard non-callable preferred stock.
Okay, so callable benefits the issuer and pays a higher yield. Let's flip the script. What about convertible preferred stock? Who holds the power here?
The convertible feature benefits the investor. It puts the power in Carl's hands. It gives him the right, but not the obligation, to exchange his safe preferred shares for a set number of the company's riskier common shares.
So Carl is sitting there collecting his safe $6 dividend, but he watches the news, and Fiona's flying cars are suddenly the hottest commodity on Earth. The common stock price goes from $10 to $50 to $100 a share. Carl can pick up the phone, call his broker, and say, take my preferred stock, shred it, and hand me common stock. I want to ride this rocket ship.
Exactly. It allows the investor to capture massive capital appreciation. But the market gives nothing away for free. Because Carl is getting this incredibly valuable embedded option to switch to common stock, Fiona doesn't have to offer him a high dividend yield initially.
Right.
Therefore, convertible preferred stock pays a lower dividend rate than standard preferred stock.
Callable benefits the company, pays a higher yield. Convertible benefits the investor, pays a lower yield. That is a guaranteed point on the exam if you just understand the power dynamic.
Guaranteed.
Now, there is one more bell and whistle we need to cover, and it is a massive conceptual exception. Floating rate or adjustable rate, preferred stock.
Oh, this one is tricky. We established an ironclad rule earlier. Because preferred stock has a fixed dividend, its price acts like a bond. It operates on that yield seesaw. When interest rates go up, the price of the preferred stock must go down to compensate.
I want to introduce a mechanical analogy for floating rate preferred. I want you to think of a car driving down a very bumpy road. The road represents the constantly changing interest rates in the economy. Every time the Federal Reserve raises rates, the car hits a massive pothole.
Ooh.
If you are driving a standard fixed-rate preferred stock, your car basically has no suspension. Every time you hit a pothole, the entire chassis of the car slams into the ground. The price of the stock drops violently.
But a floating-rate preferred stock has an active hydraulic shock absorber built right into it. The dividend's not fixed at $6 forever. Instead, the prospectus states that the dividend will reset every quarter based on a benchmark, like the current yield of the U.S. Treasury bill.
So, the Federal Reserve raises rates, the car hits a pothole, but instead of the chassis slamming into the ground, the shock absorber rapidly expands. The dividend payout automatically increases from $6 to $8 to match the new economic reality.
Because the dividend dynamically adjusts to match the current market yield, the underlying price of the stock doesn't have to drop. The chassis stays perfectly level. The price remains relatively stable, hovering right around its par value, regardless of what interest rates are doing.
So if you see a question that asks, which of the following securities is the least sensitive to changes in interest rates? And your choices are a 30-year treasury bond, a fixed-rate preferred stock, or a floating-rate preferred stock.
The answer is the floating-rate preferred. The shock absorber absorbs the interest rate volatility, protecting the principal price of the asset.
I want to pivot back to the convertible feature for a moment because the conceptual idea of swapping preferred for common is easy, but the exam is going to make you do the actual math. Carl is a cautious guy. He isn't just going to blindly swap his safe shares. He needs to know the exact mathematical breaking point where converting actually makes him a profit.
This is the realm of convertible math and the concept of parity. It is not complex calculus. It is basic algebra, but you must know the formula's cold. Let's define the two critical terms first.
Lay them on me.
Term number one, the conversion ratio. This is simply the fixed number of common shares Carl receives if he turns in one preferred share.
Term number two, the conversion price. This is the effective mathematical price Carl is paying for those common shares when he converts.
The formula for conversion price is straightforward. You take the par value of the preferred stock and you divide it by the conversion ratio.
Let's run a scenario. Listener, you're back in the hot seat. Grab your mental calculator.
You can do this.
Cautious Carl buys a brand new convertible preferred stock. The par value is $100. He reads the prospectus, and it explicitly states that the conversion ratio is 4. That means one preferred share can be swapped for 4 common shares. What is Carl's conversion price?
Got it.
The math is $100 par value divided by the ratio of 4 equals $25. Carl's conversion price is $25 per share.
Okay, let's stop and think about what that $25 actually means in the real world. By buying this preferred stock, Carl has essentially bought an option to purchase common stock at a locked-in price of $25, regardless of what the common stock is doing on the open market.
Exactly. So to figure out if Carl should actually pull the trigger and convert, we have to calculate parity, which is also called the conversion value.
Conversion value is simply calculating what Carl's preferred share would be worth if he ripped it up, converted it into common stock today, and immediately sold those common shares at the current market price.
The formula is the conversion ratio multiplied by the current market price of the common stock. Let's run scenario A, a massive bull market. Fiona invents a zero-emission flying engine. Her common stock, which usually trades around $15, suddenly spikes on the open market. It is now trading at $35 a share. Carl sees this and starts doing the math.
Carl knows his ratio is 4. He multiplies 4 shares by the current market price of $35. 4 times $35 equals $140.
His preferred stock originally cost him $100, but its conversion value is now $140. He is sitting on a massive embedded 40% profit. He converts, he takes his 4 common shares, sells them for $140, and walks away thrilled.
This is exactly why investors accept a lower initial dividend for convertible stock. They want to ride that upside. But let's look at scenario B, because this is where the exam lays a brilliant conceptual trap.
Scenario B, the bear market. A Fiona's flying car crashes into a prominent national monument. The PR is a disaster. The common stock plummets. It drops all the way down to $15 a share.
Let's do the math on the conversion value. Carl's ratio is 4. We multiply 4 shares by the new market price of $15. 4 times $15 equals $60. The conversion value of his preferred stock is only $60.
So here is the multi-million dollar question. The conversion value is $60. Does the actual market price of Carl's preferred stock plummet from $100 all the way down to $60? Does he lose 40% of his investment?
Emphatically, no. And this introduces the rule of the higher value. A convertible preferred stock will always trade at the high year error of two distinct values, its conversion value or its investment value.
Let's define investment value mechanically. The investment value is what the stock is worth purely as a fixed income instrument based on its dividend yield compared to the rest of the market. Let's assume interest rates haven't changed, so based purely on its $6 dividend, its investment value is still a solid $100.
So we compare the two numbers. The conversion value is $60. The investment value is $100. The stock trades at the higher number. It trades at $100.
Carl looks at the $60 conversion value and laughs. He says, why would I ever convert and lose $40? I'll just keep holding my preferred stock and cashing my $6 dividend checks.
This mathematical reality creates a price floor for the preferred stock. The fixed dividend acts as a safety net. If the common stock crashes, the preferred stock falls alongside it only until it hits its investment value. Once it hits that floor, it stops falling, even if the common stock goes all the way to zero.
It is the ultimate asymmetrical bet. The price floor limits your downside, but the conversion ratio gives you a ladder to climb the upside. It's a beautiful piece of financial engineering.
Truly beautiful.
But I want to throw a wrench into the math. The Series 66 loves to test anti-dilution covenants. What happens to Carl's convertible math if Fiona decides to do a 2-for-1 split on her common stock?
Oh, the exam writers want to ensure you understand that stock splits are mathematically neutral. A 2-for-1 split doubles the number of shares in existence, but cuts the price of each share in half. If Carl's conversion ratio stayed at 4, he would be severely diluted. His conversion value would be cut in half overnight through no fault of his own.
To prevent Fiona from legally robbing Carl like this, the convertible preferred stock comes with an anti-dilution covenant. If Fiona does a 2-for-1 split on the common stock, Carl's conversion ratio automatically adjusts by the exact same proportion.
Right. His old ratio was 4, the 2-for-1 split doubles it, his new ratio is 8. And because his ratio doubled, his effective conversion price is cut in half, dropping from $25 down to $12.50. The math perfectly equalizes, and Carl maintains his exact proportional claim on the common equity.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time talking about cautious Carl and his retail investing strategies. But there is a third character in our study group who has been sitting quietly in the corner, furiously calculating tax liabilities on a spreadsheet.
Corporate Chris.
Corporate Chris, the slick treasurer with a massive corporate bank account to invest. Why is a multi-billion dollar corporation interested in Fiona's preferred stock?
This brings us to the final and perhaps most complex piece of our deep dive, the tax man. To understand Chris's angle, we have to look at the massive philosophical rift between how the IRS views debt versus how it views equity.
Let's go back to Fiona. She is trying to raise capital. She can either issue bonds debt or she can issue preferred stock equity. Let's look at debt first. When Fiona issues a bond, she promises to pay interest every year. How does the IRS view that interest payment?
The IRS views interest payments on debt as a strict cost of doing business. It is an operational expense. Therefore, every single dollar of interest Fiona pays to her bondholders is fully tax deductible. It lowers her corporation's taxable income. The federal government is effectively subsidizing her debt.
It's an incredible deal for Fiona, but what if she issues preferred stock instead? We've established that preferred stock feels like debt. It pays a fixed rate, but legally it is equity.
Because it is equity, the IRS views the dividend payout very differently. They do not view it as a cost of doing business. They view it as a distribution of net profits after the business has successfully operated. Therefore, preferred dividends are not tax deductible for the issuer. Fiona has to pay Carl $6 out of her after-tax profits.
So from Fiona's perspective, issuing preferred stock is incredibly punitive. It costs her more. She has to offer a higher yield to attract investors because it's riskier than a bond. And she doesn't get to write off the expense on her taxes. Why would anyone ever issue preferred stock under these conditions?
We mentioned it earlier. To avoid the risk of bankruptcy and to maintain control of the common voting rights, It is an expensive insurance policy against corporate default.
Okay, so the tax code punishes the issuer of preferred stock, but let's look at the other side of the transaction. Let's look at the receiver. Enter corporate Chris.
Here he comes.
Chris has $50 million of his corporation's spare cash that he needs to invest. He wants a safe, fixed yield. If Chris buys $50 million worth of corporate bonds, he will collect millions in interest. How is that interest taxed?
For a corporation, interest income from a corporate bond is fully taxable as ordinary income. Chris will pay the maximum corporate tax rate on every dollar of interest he receives. It is highly inefficient.
But if Chris takes that same $50 million and buys Fiona's preferred stock, a massive, heavily guarded loophole in the tax code swings wide open.
It is called the dividends received deduction, or the DRD. To understand why the DRD exists, you have to follow a single dollar of profit through the economy and watch how the IRS treats it.
Let's follow the dollar. Fiona's flying cars makes $1 of profit. The IRS immediately taxes it at the corporate level. Let's say Fiona has 80 cents left. Fiona takes that 80 cents and pays it as a preferred dividend to corporate Chris.
Now, Chris's corporation has received 80 cents of income. If the IRS taxed that 80 cents at the corporate level again, Chris might only have 60 cents left.
Then Chris takes that 60 cents and pays it out as a dividend to his own retail shareholders. The IRS taxes those individuals on their dividend income. By the time that original dollar reaches a human being, it has been taxed three separate times. The effective tax rate could be over 70%. It would destroy corporate investment.
Recognizing this devastating triple taxation effect, the IRS created the dividends received deduction. The rule states that when one C corporation receives a dividend from another U.S. corporation, they are allowed to deduct a massive percentage of that dividend from their taxable income.
They get to just wipe it off the ledger. The exam is going to test you on the specific tiers of this deduction. It is a sliding scale based entirely on how much of Fiona's company Chris manages to buy. Break down the tiers.
The first tier is for minority ownership.
Yeah.
If Chris's corporation owns less than 20% of Fiona's voting stock, he receives a 50% dividend deduction.
Let's do the math on that. If Chris receives $1,000,000 in preferred dividends, he gets to deduct 50% of it. He only pays taxes on $500,000. The other $500,000 is completely tax-free income to his corporation. That is an astonishing yield advantage over a fully taxable bond.
It gets better. The second tier. If Chris's corporation buys a larger stake, between 20% and 79% of Fiona's company, the deduction jumps to 65%.
He pays taxes on barely a third of his income. And what if Chris is a shark and his conglomerate initiates a hostile takeover and buys 80% or more of Fiona's company?
At 80% ownership, the IRS considers the two companies to be an affiliated group. They are essentially one economic entity. At that tier, Chris receives a 100% deduction. Every single dollar of dividend income flows between the two corporations completely tax-free.
This is why corporate Chris loves preferred stock. The after-tax yield on a 6% preferred stock with a DRD can completely crush the after-tax yield of an 8% corporate bond.
But here is where the exam writers set their trap. They will give you a convoluted scenario about tax brackets and dividends, and they will ask you what the tax impact is. You have to stop and ask yourself, WHO am I being asked about?
Exactly. Let's run down the three players really quick. Player one, the issuer, founder Fiona. What is her tax deduction for paying the dividend?
Zero. She gets nothing.
Player two, the corporate investor, corporate Chris. What is his deduction?
He gets the massive DRD, ranging from 50% to 100% tax-free.
Player three, the retail investor, cautious Carl. Carl is sitting at home in his pajamas, investing his IRA. He receives his $6 preferred dividend. Does Carl get the 50% dividends received deduction?
And no. And this is where candidates lose a point. The DRD is strictly, exclusively a corporate tax break. It exists to prevent corporate triple taxation. Cautious Carl is an individual. He gets zero deduction. He pays his standard qualified or non-qualified dividend tax rates on the entire $6.
You must read the identity of the investor in the question carefully. The exact same financial instrument has wildly different tax consequences depending on the legal structure of the entity holding the shares.
Read the prompt twice. Always.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the architecture of equity. We have ripped up the floorboards. We've seen the empty Tupperware of the common stockholder at the back of the bankruptcy buffet.
Poor Carl.
We've traced the logistical hurdles of the 1920s that led to the creation of ADRs and seen how currency fluctuations can eviscerate a foreign dividend. We've watched the preferred stock yield seesaw react to the Federal Reserve, and we've followed the corporate dollar through the IRS loopholes to corporate Chris.
It is a lot of complex interlocking mechanics. So to make sure it is locked in for the exam, it is time for the rapid fire recap. I am going to throw a concept and I want you to give me the absolute most testable takeaway.
I am ready. Let's execute.
Let's start with corporate liquidation priority.
Secured debt, unsecured debt, preferred stock, common stock. Common stock bears the absolute maximum risk and gets whatever is left over, which is usually nothing.
American depository receipts, ADRs.
They eliminate the logistical friction of foreign investing. They trade in U.S. dollars on U.S. exchanges. But, and this is the key, they still carry massive currency risk because the underlying asset in the foreign vault is priced in a foreign currency.
The fixed dividend of preferred stock.
It is a maximum rate, not a guarantee. The board of directors must actively declare it. If they skip it, it is not an event of default, and the company cannot be forced into bankruptcy.
The dividend drama. Cumulative versus straight preferred.
Cumulative creates a magical bucket of arrears. All missed dividends must be paid in full before common stockholders get a dime. But they accrue zero interest. Straight preferred. If they skip it, it vanishes into thin air forever.
Interest rate sensitivity for preferred stock.
Fixed rate preferred acts exactly like a bond rates go up, price goes down to maintain yield parity, but floating rate preferred is the exception. Its internal shock absorber adjusts the payout to the market, keeping the underlying price relatively stable.
Convertible preferred valuation in a bear market.
It creates a mathematical price floor. It trades at the higher of its investment value as a fixed income asset, or its conversion value as common equity. It stops falling once it hits its investment value floor.
And finally, the tax treatment of preferred dividends.
The issuer gets absolutely zero deduction. It is paid with after-tax profits. Individual investors like Carl pay normal tax rates, but corporate investors like Chris get the massive dividends received deduction, making it a highly tax-efficient corporate investment.
Flawless execution. If you understand the causality behind those takeaways, you are going to master this section of the 66.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought. Something to chew on while you're reviewing your flashcards. We just spent an hour proving that preferred stock is a mathematically terrible deal for the issuing company.
It really is.
It offers absolutely no tax deduction, unlike debt. And because it is riskier for the investor than a bond, the company has to offer a much higher dividend yield to sell it. It is, objectively, the most expensive way to raise fixed income capital.
It makes no economic sense on paper.
Right. So why does it exist in such massive quantities? The next time you are looking at the balance sheet of a massive, systemically important commercial bank like a JP Morgan or Bank of America, look very closely at their capital structure. You will see billions and billions of dollars of preferred stock issued.
Ask yourself, if it's so expensive, why are the smartest financial engineers in the world issuing it? What are they trying to hide from their debt-to-equity ratios?
It is a brilliant question about regulatory capital requirements. The Federal Reserve legally caps how much debt a bank can take on. So the banks issue an instrument that behaves exactly like debt, but is legally classified as equity. It is a regulatory illusion.
The centaur strikes again.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Go master these concepts, recognize the exam traps before they spring, and absolutely crush that Series 66 exam. We'll see you next time.